Well, welcome to Sparkle On. I define sparkle as your happiness, passion, and self-worth. So this podcast is really about where passion equals purpose and purpose equals change. And why I wanted to have you on is because you are one of the change makers that I admire, especially in the film world. So for those of you guys who don't know, Carrie Stett is a director, writer, and she is an extreme advocate for specifically Title IX and women athletics. And that's what a lot of her films and different campaigns focus on. She has been a director for companies like Kleenex, Ford, Barbie, and Disney, and she's won numerous awards, specifically with social impact at the forefront. And so that's really what I admire about you. I wanted to start with the beginning of your career. And I wanted to ask, like, did you always know you wanted to be a director?
No, I didn't. But thank you for that kind introduction. No, I didn't. I wanted to be a professional tennis player. So that was my goal. Mm-hmm. And when it didn't work out, I went to sort of an equally difficult career path, which was to become a director. That was my second choice. Uh-huh. And so in a way, I kind of feel like I'm combining the two a little bit now by telling stories, you know, about women in sports. So
what was that initial spark? Like, I always love capturing creative stories when they realize maybe it's one memory or maybe it's a combination. So did you have that when tennis wasn't necessarily going in the career direction that you initially planned?
Yeah. I mean, I had it from an early age, the desire to like write and direct things. And I even, you know, spoke to an old friend from school, you know, recently, and she's like, "You were always doing that. You don't remember?" So yeah, I think I used to have my little brother and sister like act out things for me and try to film them. So I guess technically I'd always been thinking about it. Uh-huh. But I think the spark was evolved over time, but mm-hmm. it definitely came from seeing Spielberg films. Mm-hmm. To me, those are most impactful, you know, as a kid. E.T.
Yeah,
it's just like some of those films just really stuck with me.
It's so interesting because I feel like I've said this on a couple episodes now, but even in my own life, I've been practicing a lot about going back to that inner child, that inner girl, and the skills that maybe we didn't think of as skills, right? We were playing, and you were just another creative person that I've talked to that you were saying you were playing with your siblings. So what was actually that time where you made the leap of faith to do this for your career?
Well, when I made the leap of faith, I didn't know that I could be a director. I didn't know that was a path. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to work in storytelling. And so I, you know, went to a school that had a program. I went to Emerson College. They had a program where you could learn the skills, and also moved out to Los Angeles to make coffee and do all the things that you do. But even still, and you know, it took a while for me to realize, and this is the see it, be it thing, that I didn't see women really doing that. And it certainly wasn't an environment that supported that, you know. So it's taken me a while to realize that's something I can do.
Yeah. And then what were like some of the memories or the instances where you did feel ready to go after that? Like, where it gave you the confidence that you are a director? And because I feel like sometimes I know I really struggled with calling myself a writer until I put myself through the MFA program. And even after the MFA program, I went to school with a lot of talented people. And I know writing's a part of me. I know I have other skill sets. I don't know if it was just like cultural upbringing too, is like just the stigmas of what it means to be an artist. And then I had to start practicing in the mirror, like, I am a writer. Were you always calling yourself a director?
No. In fact, I wanted to be. To me, I thought writing was the path. Mm-hmm. But then there was one project where I was sent out. It was actually some spots for Kleenex brand. I was sent out to tell these stories of people who had extraordinary stories. And I was technically a producer on that project, but just kind of sent out to create this video. Mm-hmm. And the writer in me, you know, knew how to tell it. But I realized very quickly that for me, it was about the visuals and crafting them, and how when you craft them right, they could create emotion and something that you're viewing. And so that's where I sort of just learned by doing. But what was great is I was given the freedom to do that on that project.
And is that, was that your debut as a director?
I wasn't even called a director at that point. Uh-huh. I was just, you know, sent out to make this thing. It was a social media thing.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I wasn't called a director yet. It wasn't really until actually one of those pieces ended up being a part of the shoot, New Director Showcase. And that was probably the first time I'd ever been called a director.
Mm. Yeah. That's amazing. And I feel like I hear a lot of stories, especially in Hollywood, where you kind of just stumble into these titles, whether you're going after or not. What were some of the steps that you think you gained as you were, because you said you were getting coffee for people. What was kind of that ladder? Or maybe it wasn't a ladder. Maybe it was kind of like all over the place.
I think it's a little bit all over the place. Yeah. But yeah, definitely, you know, made the coffees and ran the errands and did those things. I guess the ladder was that starting at the bottom. Mm-hmm. But just along the way, trying to figure out where do I fit in this puzzle? You know, which department would I be right in? And because you have ideas of what you want to do, but then how realistically do you get there? And I wasn't sure. Mm-hmm. So I just kept trying every opportunity to get chances to tell a story in any way I could. So I can't say there was a clear path. I just knew this is the skill I want to keep doing and kept trying to get access to it.
And I think what's so interesting is, like, I know I've felt this where I've gone out to LA and I've tried to fit a certain box. Mm-hmm. And what I've learned, especially with even building Sparkle and what I defined as kind of like my ethos and guiding light, is that there really isn't a box. And in some ways, especially to tell the stories that you care about, you kind of have to have this grounded, rooting nature about you. And eventually you do. You get certain titles like director, producer. And there's so many. I think Shonda Rhimes said it. She said, if you have a specific thing that's your skill set, whether you train dogs or what, there's a job for you in Hollywood.
See, I never known that. So I wouldn't really share any. Like, I wouldn't mention that I, you know, played a sport or did, you know, had an interest, like what people might consider interesting. I just kind of hid that.
Right.
And didn't see it as a strength. But now people, you know, now you can use those things as strengths. So it's really cool. I think for me, the sparkle as a director is your voice. Mm-hmm. So it's like finding that. But to me, it's been so fun to try to find that. Mm-hmm. It evolves.
So what advice would you actually give someone? Because what I define sparkle as so many different things. Like, I'm a rosé drinker. I'm a producer. I'm a writer. I love the food and beverage industry. I'm a craft beer snob. Like, those are all the things that make me sparkle. But especially when you're trying to grow in your career with a purpose, how did you really start to find that footing for yourself? Like you said, you were a tennis player. What were those moments where you just started to take ownership of your voice?
Well, when I started seeing one of these pieces that I mentioned that I first did when I wasn't yet a director, they were on social media and I saw the response. Mm-hmm. So unlike putting a, you know, feature film out, putting something on social, you see all the comments.
Right.
You could see what people responded to. And that was really cool. And I learned something from that. Oh, maybe that's good. Mm-hmm. So that's been really useful in developing. Okay, well, maybe I'll go that direction. Mm-hmm. Maybe that was a good choice. So and then, you know, during COVID, I think I was struggling a little bit. What is my voice? And I sort of stepped back and thought, well, what do I care about? Well, I do care about women in sports, because that's been a lot my journey. And I don't see those stories told a lot. So I decided to just, you know, lean way into that. And it's just been super fun. I've been having a good time because that's where my passion lies.
And for the listeners that don't know about Carrie, when she leaned in, she directed a TBS documentary about Title IX. It's called Title IX, 37 Words That Changed America. I'm a big Title IX advocate. I read about the updates of Title IX through and through per every administration. Title IX is the civil rights law that essentially prohibits sex discrimination in the education world. So that includes K through 12 and also higher education. A lot of people know it as the civil rights law that allowed women to play sports in school, but it also has numerous protections, whether that's prevention of sexual harassment, violence, and I think where it gets a little conflated sometimes is people think it's similar to the criminal justice system, and it's really not. It's really about ensuring that someone can finish their schooling without any barriers to that education. So there's accommodations if you were to experience certain things. And really, Title IX is probably the reason we're able to have this conversation. So can you go into a little bit of how you came to understand what Title IX was, whether that was your time during as an athlete or doing this project?
Definitely during my time as an athlete. I think when Sedona Prince, you know, showed us what it was really like backstage, so to speak, I mean, that's just the story of being a female athlete from what was my experience even a decade prior to that. So I think just realizing, wait, you know, things a little bit different, you know, for the boys than what we have. Yeah. And just kind of, I was aware of it. But then as a filmmaker, started to think about, well, what, you know, the women's soccer team and thinking about the 99ers and starting to do some research into that because I was interested in that story and realizing there's a much bigger picture here, mm-hmm. that all of that is due to Title IX. Yeah. And even, you know, things like Angel City and what we have today and the growth of these sports goes right back to that. Mm-hmm. But Title IX was not really meant to be about sports.
Right.
It was meant as educational, you know, equality in education, mm-hmm. opportunities. And so because of the word activity got added, then that opened the door and it's just been changed everything.
Yeah, no, it really has. And that's why it's so important to maintain the Department of Education and Title IX. And, you know, each administration, it goes through a series of revisions. It seems like over the years, there was a lot of progress made under the Obama administration. And advocates, some believe that there was some rollbacks during the Trump administration. And now there will be a new Title IX enacted as of August 1st, 2024. And so can you actually speak to some of the research and development during your time of writing this film, kind of what you had to juggle with all those ups and downs as the law has changed over the years?
Yeah, I mean, we really spent a lot of time in the film just trying to explain what it was. I think mm-hmm. it's very hard to condense. I mean, it's a very lengthy,
yes.
a process and history. Mm-hmm. So trying to condense it down in a way that can be understood and the impact on sports is kind of where we stayed versus sort of the, you know, evolution over time. But it has over time, you know, faced threats and been, you know, I know that, you know, Billie Jean King has multiple times had to, you know, speak before Congress mm-hmm. About it to help preserve it. So I think it's constantly under, I mean, maybe threat isn't the best word, but it's constantly being relooked at. But because times are changing mm-hmm. and it makes sense, it's just that, you know, we have to kind of look at each revision as what is the larger impact. And we're under some serious changes coming. And yeah. But yeah, for the film, we didn't really get that deep into it in that sense. We're really looking at it from three generations of Candace Parker's mm-hmm. family and how you can see just from her example what it's been able to do.
And what was it like working with one of the biggest WNBA legends of all time?
I mean, amazing. Yeah. She's amazing. And I mean, and just meeting her family and, you know, one of our days of filming, we went to her mom's house and looked at old photos together. Her mom has a lot of old photos. And we're just looking at these photos. It was such a, you know, privilege to be able to sit with her. But once she opened one of the photo books and there was an old article from an old article about Title IX that she had put in there, you know, many years ago. So she knew. And so, of course, we filmed that. But like that just said to me everything that we all know about it, athletes. Right. But it's like, how do we process what to do about it or what it has even meant for us?
I know. It's so funny because I talk to, you know, I still have a lot of athletes in my community. And it's like there's a certain knowledge. They might not know exactly what it is because when you go, especially in college, you have to go through the training. And you kind of just click through it. We all did it. But I feel like that was my first memory. I feel like the only other memory I had of it was in high school. I wanted to do field hockey and cross country, and they were both in the same fall season. And it was a whole fight for many different reasons. But one of the things I came home to my dad because he supported me. My dad has always supported my goals and ambitions and my family, my mom, my sister. But my dad was one of those, you know, very big advocates, very vocal advocate. I wonder where I get it from. But I said, you know, the soccer players on the boys, they get to be the kickers on the football team. And that was enough. And that is really what, when I went to the high school administration and said, I'm going to play field hockey and cross country, get over it. That's what allowed me to do that, not knowing that by law they had to. And then in college, when I started to be impacted by other things in my athletic career, that's when I really started learning about Title IX. But before that, it was that click through a course. And so what do you think, I mean, obviously your films are doing it, but what do you think are other ways, especially you might even with your daughter who plays sports now, what are ways to educate young athletes and students in general about their rights? Because they are rights from the kindergarten age.
I mean, I think just kind of like, it sounds like what your dad did is react and show us what maybe to fight for or what to ask for even. Mm-hmm. It's not, sometimes you just need to ask or, you know that you something's a possibility. So I think it's supporting our kids who want to play sports. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think there's a statistic now that girls are dropping out of sports at a teenage, in their teenage years. And that's definitely not, you know, what we want to happen. So it's like, why is that happening? Is that because of lack of opportunity down the road, or some other things? But I think we just have to educate our own children. I don't know that anyone else will do it for us.
Yeah. And it's so interesting because one of the things you start to also realize is when you send a kid to school, you might see them at breakfast time. They're spending hours with maybe multiple different teachers, and then at least 2 hours at minimum at practice with a coach, and then maybe you see your kid for dinner, depending on a parent's like work schedule and things like that. So it really goes back to the saying that it takes a community to raise a child. And so how do you think as a parent yourself that you can bridge kind of the education with coaches and teachers and what you're talking about?
God, there's so many levels. I mean, storytelling, I think, can make a big impact. And if we see examples, and it doesn't have to be like educational films, it could be, for example, something I'd love to see is, you know, a series about girls playing sports.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I mean, like, if these are the topics that we're watching and seeing this imagery, then it's not a question for, you know, the next generation that that's something they can do. So I think seeing it and showing them that, but also like just, you know, talking about it. I think education coaches, I mean, I think they, many of them could just educate us. They know the system and hopefully they're, you know, we have more and more coaches in place who are, I think we do have that for coaches out there, you know, creating opportunities. Mm-hmm. It's just, yeah, I don't know. That's a really tough one. I think as a storyteller and a parent, I'm trying to make films that appeal to a younger audience because to me, that's where you make those decisions in life.
Right. And then, well, I also found it interesting in this documentary, though, you utilize men's voices as well. So you had Shaquille O'Neal, Magic Johnson, Peyton Manning. And in that film, how were you able to see how their voices maybe rounded out this perspective? Because some of the perspective around Title IX is that it's a women's issue, but that's really not true at all. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's important. I mean, they're girl dads. Their daughters play sports. Look at Shaquille O'Neal. And so I think like It impacts all of us, right? Mm-hmm. So there's no, and you know, just there's a lot of also sentiment that Title IX is taking something away from men's sports. I know I've heard that a lot. That's not the intention. The intention is to create equality based on the percentage of the population at a particular school. So it's not, actually doesn't always mean a 50-50 split. It's based on, I believe, the percentage of the population at schools.
Right.
So each school could be a little different in how it's allocated. But yeah, I think men's voices are important. I mean, look at the WNBA. And I mean, that's one thing that we research heavily is the history and the track record of how a league like that, a women's league, can succeed. Mm-hmm. And look how long it's taken for women's basketball. WNBA is not the first league. It's something like the ninth professional women's league to be attempted.
Right.
So if we think about that, you know, there's a lot of, you know, starts and stops prior to that. So the WNBA success, that there's been a lot of the male players have spoken out in support of it, and that's been a huge help. So I think having male voices is super important. I love seeing the girl dads. You know, I go to Angel City games.
The games are so fun.
They're amazing.
The food is good.
Food is great. It's important.
Very important for me. I don't know why. I was just, before we started this podcast, I was like, we're in Austin, Texas right now. I got to figure out how to get all the food scenes taken care of, because that's just what I think of when I go somewhere.
I'll help you. We'll make a map.
Okay, amazing. I'm very excited.
Yeah, but I mean, just, you know, more and more you seeing all the girl dads. It's not just moms and daughters.
Yeah.
It's dads and daughters and sons.
Yes.
I think that's just awesome.
Yeah. And one of the short films that you did, which was really great, is elevating a certain, breaking the stigma of certain narratives, was First Down. And it was highlighting young girls playing tackle football. Can you speak more to that project?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I always secretly wanted to play tackle football.
Me too. I asked and I wasn't allowed. I wanted to play tackle football so badly.
Right?
Yes.
I mean, it's just more fun. I wanted to play baseball and not softball. It's just, I don't know why.
Yeah.
But that to me seemed more fun. And I, you know, my child was a lot in the front yard. My dad, who was a pitcher in Little League, teaching me how to pitch and throw the ball. So that to me was just like, why can't I play? Mm-hmm. So then when I realized that there were, well, I set out to find who are the young women today, like pushing boundaries. Mm-hmm. And when I found this league, it's the like first and I think only remaining youth girls tackle football league in the United States. I was just blown away, and it just keeps growing. But like, I was just in awe of them and thought, well, this is a story that needs to be told. Mm-hmm. I want to see that normalized, and I want to see tackle football for women. Why not?
What I found so inspiring and compelling was, for those of you that want to read it, there is a write-up about it in the Washington Post, but a lot of these emotions of these young girls were very similar to what young men express as what football does for them. And when I think back to those times that I wanted to play tackle football, is that it wasn't so much about the actual tackling or even the game of football. It was wanting an activity to express myself in a way that I didn't know how to do with words, which is ultimately why I do think I became a writer. I think it's why a lot of athletes actually do lean to storytelling after they finish their careers, because they finally do get to have that expression of that voice. And so I know that you've worked with a lot of high-profile athletes that are now leaning into that, but what do you think are ways that we can start that at a young age? I don't think that it's a bad thing to be able to express ourselves in sport. But I think it's also healthy to be able to communicate with words. And where do you kind of find that balance?
So do you mean like in having or encouraging like young players kind of talk about, because what we uncovered with this team was some mental health issues going on with mm-hmm. them. Mm-hmm. That's tough. I think, you know, when you're a coach, you're a little bit a counselor too, right?
Yeah.
I mean, especially with kids. I know I did coach college at the collegiate level for a couple of years, and you're a confidant and a support system. Mm-hmm. I think what I saw on that team is that the team supported each other, and that's the best case scenario, right? Mm-hmm. They became sisters, and that helped them through. And so, you know, I think encouraging to talk about it versus, you know, keep things inside, it seemed to really work mm-hmm. for that team. And, you know, I wonder if, you know, that'll be happening more and more, or maybe teams and leagues will start to, you know, offer some resources for players who, you know, who need it. Maybe right. there's a way to kind of catch some of those things in sport and help people out. That would be great.
Yeah, because I think it's we had an amazing episode a couple weeks ago. Brandon Seho, he started a podcast called The Mental Game, and he did a tour around the U.S., 30 states in 30 days, where he was talking to schools. And I asked, like, where does a school's responsibility come in? And it's the same thing with sports leagues, especially youth sports leagues. It's like, where does it become a responsibility to address their mental health? And to his point, it's like there needs to be more resources, but there's never more money for those resources. And when we think about some of these youth programs, it's a lot of fundraising from local communities. And that is also another way that we can talk about the importance of Title IX, because Title IX offers that federal funding to schools. And if it's in violation, it can be stripped. If the school is in violation. And so I think where these stories matter and these conversations matter is, especially if there's not more money for resources, it's almost we have to break this stigma. And we all have to be more educated in mental health in order to help these children thrive in their sport. So what are ways that you kind of practice this, either with your daughter's teams or things like that, where you're helping them kind of express their feelings or what they have to say?
You know, I haven't been in that capacity on my daughter's teams. I would say it's come through because I've been now working on some projects mm-hmm. at the high school level with some sports teams. And I think, you know, the coaches, yeah, I'm supposed to be an observer, right? As a filmmaker. But I can see the coaches doing that. I can see that is present, and it's a cool thing to see. I don't know. I think that what was the question again? It's like, how do you
encourage young people to, especially, feel okay with expressing themselves mm-hmm. and provide that safe space?
I think coaches can really do that. Mm-hmm. You know, the film First Down is has become a teaching tool, which is not it was not expected. I was just trying to find a cool story, and you know, but I think what happened was the girls opened up because, you know, it seemed like they hadn't maybe before, but for the first time, like, someone was interested. And so I think just being interested in someone, like, a coach can do that. Mm-hmm. And I think they do. I mean, more and more. And this film, I've been getting, you know, random, like, teachers reach out to me. Hey, I saw this. I'm like, where did you find this? Can we show it in our classroom? And so I'm like, yeah. And every time I'm always like, if there's anything you need from me, or if you want me to connect, whatever, just, you know. But I think that having a tool like that, maybe a film, can mm-hmm. help spark a conversation for someone who, you know, maybe wasn't comfortable, you know, addressing something, and they see that they're not alone, mm-hmm. right? But when you're young, you don't realize that.
And as a director, you said, you know, you're mostly an observer, but what were ways that you did have to provide that space for people to open up? Like, what was that experience like, especially for young women?
Yeah, it was a process. I mean, it started with, you know, getting to know them over Zoom. Mm-hmm. It was multiple, you know, conversations leading up to being, you know, there with a camera. Mm-hmm. So talking to their parents, you know, mm-hmm. just trying to really understand them before. And I think, you know, people can suss you out really quickly whether you are genuine or not. And I guess they realized I was genuine and really wanted to know their stories. Mm-hmm. But it also was about talking to the parents too, because, you know, as a parent, I just wanted to make sure that, you know, I understood the whole story and that the parents were okay with them talking about it. Mm-hmm. It just, you know, you really want to make sure that it, whatever your story you're telling, is protecting the subjects.
Right. And then how do you ensure the protecting? You mentioned listening, of course, and getting multiple perspectives, but what are other ways?
Or if there's something that they shared that they later didn't want to talk about, giving mm-hmm. them the option to mm-hmm. to remove it. Mm-hmm. So that was always an option going in, and just letting them feel assured of that. Also, their coach was very involved. The coach was part of it. And so right. it was the, you know, a circle of trust for sure. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's just, you know, a process.
And we talked a little bit about the WNBA and the rapid growth. So what excites you the most about that, first and foremost?
Because, well, there's so many exciting things.
Please share them all.
But because, so I've been, you know, working on telling the story of the WBL, which is one of the, well, the first viable women's pro league, just like late 70s, mm-hmm. early 80s, that's pretty forgotten. Mm-hmm. But this was where some of those strides started to be made. And so the WNBA, you know, we talked about the history in our documentary, but I just never realized how long, you know, what a struggle it has been mm-hmm. To get to where we are today. So it's just, you know, this is that sort of coming together of all the things, you know, PR, you know, having the Caitlin Clark effect. I mean, you know, she's unbelievable, but we're also in the right time in history for that to take fire and that story and people to be interested. So it's kind of, I mean, who knows where we'll go from here, but I hope it goes into there being, you know, more funding mm-hmm. across the board, but also this being an example of a women's league that can be replicated in other sports.
I do think this morning they actually announced like a $2.2 billion investment into the streaming of like ESPN, like all the streamers came together. I just saw it like right before our episode, ironically.
Great. Well, I'll be watching.
Yeah.
People want to watch.
And I kind of just love too how it's every industry that is getting involved, whether it's a makeup company, whether it's fashion, you know, a lot of these role models that we're seeing, the women athlete basketball players, is like, they're also becoming fashion icons. Not that they weren't already. It's just now brands are recognizing it. Mm-hmm. And how do you think the NIL has also played a role in that? I mean, you mentioned Caitlin Clark, of course.
I mean, the NIL is changing everything too. I mean, I don't know. I don't know if we know yet how that's going to change things. It's still so early. Mm-hmm. But I wish it was around sooner and we all made lots of money.
And I do, you know, I talk to a lot of student athletes, and I do know that still the NIL is showing certain gender disparities, especially as far as it relates to the revenue making sports teams on those campuses. Where I know when the news started coming out that this was going to go through, that my hope was that the NIL would be that first like level playing ground. But you know, what's interesting is, for listeners that don't know, I met Carrie during South by Southwest this past year, and I went to a panel that talked about tech ball and pickleball and the rapid growth of pickleball.
Yes.
You might have opinions about that. I want to hear.
I'm not a pickleball person. It's all right, but yeah, I'm a tennis player.
I mean, I that makes sense. Yeah. You're like one of those people, this is not
kind of purist. No, it's fun, but it's a little loud. It's a little, you know, well, it's not the same.
What I find interesting about it, because like I go and I've played with my friends, but like I have friends that are always going to the court. And I liked the community aspect of it. But what I found interesting from that panel that I was listening to is it actually might be the one sport where women could make more or as much as men, data-wise, because one, they have mixed doubles. Mm-hmm. And because the professional trajectory to pickleball is only about 3 to 5 years, where I'm assuming you played tennis your entire life, it's an opportunity where someone can come, not even be an athlete prior, and be a professional pickleball player. And so I do wonder what the data is going to show as far as who can get sponsorships and endorsements and where women actually might lead that sport.
Yeah, to me that's super interesting. Let's do a doc on it.
I'm ready. Let's do it. I oh my gosh, it's so funny how many things come out of these podcast episodes of like, let's just do it.
We have to tell the story. No, there's a million things like that. I think that's really cool. I mean, why not? Mm-hmm. It's just I lost my train of thought. I think that's great. It, you know, the NIL and how that get split, you know, is going to be a big part of the new Title IX considerations.
Absolutely.
And I don't think it's going to be tied up super easy in August or October, whenever they said. I think it's going to be, you know, a long, long debated thing that, you know, but it's worth doing, right? Mm-hmm. It's worth figuring out how to make that fair also.
Well, there's even some advocates that are saying the NIL is in violation of Title IX. And depending on how you look at it, they're not inherently wrong for saying that, but it, at least my personal tie to both issues is both are really important, right? Like it is important for athletes to be able to monetize off their name, image, and likeness. It's important for their autonomy. It's important for, you know, before these schools were really profiting off of these student athletes, especially athletes of color. And so I understand where that perspective comes from, but there has to be a compromise at that table because we have to have Title IX in order for the NIL to work and vice versa.
Yeah, it's just a whole new, this is the example of the times changing and how do we adapt. Mm-hmm. Title IX, I wish Bernice Sandler was here and she could take care of it. She's the godmother of Title IX, and you know, we need her back.
I think if we really look at it, and I'd love to hear feedback from the listeners on this that are really passionate about the topic, but there are sometimes actually during internships that there is a hybrid of education between Title VII and Title IX. Title VII basically is around the sex discrimination in the workplace. And because the NIL is sort of that hybrid, I believe that model could provide a compromise for what is being discussed around this.
That's interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I hadn't thought of that, but yeah.
Yeah, it was actually Candy Smiley is a colleague of mine. She's the Title IX director at UCLA. I believe she was also a former athlete. We should give her a call after this. But she does that work where she basically educates the different partners that they work with, like the companies in LA, to make sure that, you know, the students are having the resources. But what people don't know, no matter the school, no matter where you are, is if you are a company hiring someone of a certain school, you're actually required to follow their Title IX guidelines. And so any sort of like a report that would be made to HR would also have to go through the Title IX system and vice versa. A lot of companies don't know that. So
yeah. And actually, you bring up a good point. Even since Title IX was passed, it took many years for it to actually be, you know, utilized because people just didn't know. And so I think there's going to be that process too. It's just people don't know.
Right.
The more we know, the more we can advocate on every level. But it's complex. So
it is. And that's why like stories like yours are, I mean, the ones that you are producing and directing are so important. And I guess to that point, like we kind of talked about the future of women's sports, but what is one thing that you want to specifically see in the future of women's sports?
Oh boy. That's really hard. One thing I would like to see, the stories being told. So that's awesome. We're going to have broadcasts, you know, live sports, but I think what makes you, you know, it's the stories that we hold dear, the story, where were you when you saw Jordan, you know, win the championship, things like that. Like, when we start having more of those as part of our, you know, storytelling, I think then it'll take on a different level. I would love to see, you know, more films and TV shows centered around, you know, these kinds of topics. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and see the stories. I know as someone who's out there actively trying to get these stories made, it's still not easy to get them made and to get the attention of distributors and you know, various entities to fund these projects.
Why do you think that is?
That's a whole different podcast. I think it's about track record. And right now, you know, maybe money's going toward broadcasting the live events versus stories that, you know, of maybe people who aren't household names. Mm-hmm. So it's just kind of the way that, you know, it's a business also. And if you tell a story about a household name, then that might get more eyeballs. But a story about an obscure, you know, female pickleball player might not, but to me that might be a better story. So it's tough. It's tough.
I think maybe if we provide a case study that every company is held liable for university Title IX and all their interns are running around Disney, they might actually think differently now. So yeah, we might have just found the solution.
We may have. It's just that I think there's a little bit of that going on, but I think now the value of those stories is starting to be seen. It's just unfortunately right now we're at the time of the industry when everything kind of shrunk. So to me, the challenge is how to keep telling those and keep them alive and keep pushing for them.
And then going off of that, then what's your biggest hope for women in the entertainment or film industry?
Same sort of thing, is like more opportunities. Mm-hmm. I know that, you know, there's been talk as if, you know, we see more female directors, but it's not really as commonplace as it could be. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's still a little bit of a, you know, I think we're still a bit unicorns.
Yeah.
And I don't want to be a unicorn.
Yeah. That makes sense. I mean, community is really what makes things change and grow. And that's kind of the purpose of this show too.
Yeah, right. So I want to be able to, you know, have more, you know, bigger projects and more ability to tell bigger stories. And I think, you know, sometimes that can be challenging to get those opportunities still. Mm-hmm. But we keep going.
And this is one of the big ethos of the show, right? Is like there are all these barriers that we are talking about and hopes for the future. But how do you personally maintain that spark for your love of storytelling? What are some like active things that you might do every day that, you know, the stories that you care about are important and some people might not see that perspective? What do you do?
I have a whiteboard where I have them all plotted out. And so I just will look back at the whiteboard and go, oh, yeah, that was a good, you know, oh, really excited about that. So it just kind of reminds me, you know, of the stories that I'm excited about. And that board is full. But it's also like, you know what, take a break from it. Go to the gym, go play tennis or pickleball.
Yeah.
But like just, you know, just kind of recenter. Mm-hmm. I think you have to kind of do that and give some creative space. Otherwise, you can get lost in the process and the barrier, the roadblocks when you hit them.
Yeah. And I find it interesting that sometimes we never always actually know how the story will come out. I think one of the things I've noticed is like, in my own creative process, is be open-minded to how a story might end up revealing itself, because that's kind of like the magic that I feel like exists in writing. And the power of story is sometimes you might think it's a book, or sometimes you might think it's a film, but then you have no idea. It might be a game. It might be an app. And there are so many opportunities that we see different producers kind of take this IP, if you really want to be technical about it, and put it in something else. And so I do think what's really cool about the sports industry is it's kind of like this middle ground between all these different industries. And maybe the way we tell stories just shows up differently.
I think too. I think definitely, you know, well, there's definitely, when you put a different, you know, director's lens on, it's going to look different. The same story could be told, you know, millions of different ways, which is kind of exciting. Mm-hmm. But I also just think that, you know, it's a lot of it is just because you can't get the funding or get, you know, a distributor greenlight the project doesn't mean it's not a good project. And I think just keeping that to heart, that doesn't mean it's not a great story. It just means that you're going to have to find another way. So not giving up and just remembering that there's nothing wrong with it.
Yeah. What is that process of fundraising look like for your projects? Or what was what are the most insightful things that you've learned from that process?
I mean, I would say that's one of them, not to give up on your idea, because you just assume it's no, no, no till you get a yes. And so I almost now just laugh at the no's because I'm ready for them.
Yeah.
But it's also just making a, you know, materials and a story, like honing and tightening it so it's undeniable. And that to me has been a long time process of learning how to do that.
Okay.
And I'm still learning.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just like, how do you shape the story you're trying to pitch? Mm-hmm. Because if it's not super clear, you know, you're already going in with a potential no. So how do you turn that?
right,
into a yes. So it's really just that making, and then also figuring out who wants to hear that story. Mm-hmm. You know,
what is your creative process for really able to like shape that story in the most refined way to get the funding?
You know, it's just been practice, but it goes back to being a writer and putting mm-hmm. that writer hat on. You know, if you have to write a log line, mm-hmm. those can be the hardest things to do.
Because they're so concise.
Yeah.
For listeners that don't know what a log line is, it's like if you go on IMDb and you see this one or two sentence blurb about the film or a TV show, that's what a log line is.
Yeah. And if you get bogged down in the detail of your story too much and the log line doesn't really say what it is, you're going to have a hard time convincing someone to give you money for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think it's just been refining and also working with people. I enjoy collaborating with other people who are, you know, more experienced and, you know, better at it than me and learning from them. So it's been like that too. Mm-hmm. It's just, you know, practice.
Yeah. Yeah. And then this might be a difficult question, but what would you say up until this point of your career has been like your favorite campaign or film project? Do you have a favorite?
That's hard. Well, I would say my favorite still goes back to the Kleenex campaign that I did because mm-hmm. it was sort of the beginning of, you know, kind of finding my voice, but also really true, raw stories that just as hard to get that opportunity to tell is these days. So, you know, that was a really cool, you know, a brand willing to do that was really visionary. And we found some of the most incredible stories just all across the U.S. So that was really fun for me. And then I would say, you know, the Title IX film, I had been already researching, wanting to do something about that for a couple of years. So. Yeah. Getting to tell that story just kind of got me started and I'm ready. I want to do more of those.
Yeah, no, we definitely need more of them. I mean, you know, I'm passionate about it.
Yeah.
One of the things I sometimes ask on the show is sometimes people get, especially with the power of social media, the good and the bad, we think about big wins as our self-worth. But what I really like to promote is that sometimes your sparkle in a day is that you really just like the lipstick you put on, or it was like you were on a run and like you saw the old man like take his wife's hand and it was just a beautiful moment. Like, and so I really want to celebrate these small wins. So what were some small wins that you maybe had this week or over the last month that made you feel like life is sparkling?
Ooh, well, this has been a tough, you picked me at a tough week because I just moved house.
Sparkle sometimes messy.
Sparkle, I think my sparkle is messy right now.
That's okay. We love that.
But you know, I think sometimes it's just been, you know what to me is always a sparkle when, I sort of had some ideas for, this goes back to work and not personal life, but I had some ideas for a few shots I wanted to do in a project and I just got the footage back and they turned out really well. And so there's that. Okay, that idea wasn't so bad after all. Aww. That's a sparkle. But to me, the other sparkle, I think I got to see my daughter figure skate yesterday.
Wow.
She's learning, she's very interested in skating. So I saw her lesson and she was doing like actual jumps.
Wow.
Like the beginnings of them. And I was just blown away because I can't even come close to doing that. Like it was just really cool to see.
Oh, that's such a hard sport too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A sport I don't know anything about other than what I have seen at the Olympics,
right.
Like watching TV.
Right. So. There's a type of fearlessness that you need. So.
Yeah. So I was excited. That made me happy.
That's amazing. Well, is there anything else that you want to share of like what's next for any upcoming projects?
What's next? I have a few balls in the air, but I really want to tell another story about women's basketball, but now the young, you know, the youth leagues mm-hmm. and what that's like for now you have NIL and all these stakes.
Yeah.
So what's happening for now young women going to basketball? It's a little bit different mm-hmm. than it used to be. So yeah, I'm kind of interested in that.
Women's basketball, women's soccer. I mean, it's all very... It's going to change the world.
Yeah. Well, I'm also interested in more obscure sports too. So to me, those are all fair game for
future but not pickleball.
Maybe. I do have a pickleball racket, I'll say.
That's amazing.
And I will play anyone who wants to play.
There is a place in Santa Monica when you come back to LA that it's like an all pink pickleball place indoors. and I've been dying to go.
Okay, I'll do that.
It's all pink. You can't say no to that.
I'm in.
Okay, maybe they have like pink water or something and I can be really excited.
And you can wear a pink. No, that sounds great to me.
Well, thank you so much for joining the show. Your career trajectory is so inspiring and I really appreciate all the advocacy that you're doing.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. This is fun to be able to talk about it. Yeah. So thanks.
Sparkle on.
Sparkle on.